Hello and welcome to Stardub episode 222.
Yes, it's all the twos at Stardub Towers here. I'm Ralph.
I'm Andy.
And you once again stumbled upon the podcast which delves into the areas of pop culture that perhaps don't get enough exposure. Or conversely, the areas of pop culture which aren't talked about with
very good reason, as we will come to very shortly.
Indeed. So, in a rare topical move, this episode has actually been broadcast close to, inverted commas, broadcast. Indeed.
You mean recorded before broadcast? As opposed to broadcast.
I mean, we are
good, but not that good. That's like, you should be listening. If you're on the ball, you'll be downloading this on Sunday about lunchtime. Well, this is a Saturday evening, and we're recording.
That's right, the Saturday of the 17th of November 2012.
Reason being is myself have had job changes and upheaval, and in quite actually related to today's episode, Mr. Burns decided that instead of recording last weekend, I went
to a Doctor Who convention.
And pray tell, what was this convention? Where was it?
This convention was called Dimensions 2012, which is apparently an annual Doctor Who convention organised by 10th Planet Events, who do various signings and one-day events and full weekend conventions and the like. So apparently this has been running for a few years now, and it takes place in Newcastle, which is why I wanted to give it a wee shot, because bizarrely, of all my interests, they've all sort of waxed and waned to certain extents and through my time, and various things have always been there. I've always enjoyed Star Trek, I've always enjoyed Marvel Comics and things like that, but even though they've remained constant through my lifetime, Doctor Who is the one thing where I am the diehard of the diehards, and from a very young age, as far back as I can remember, I've always loved it with an undimmed enthusiasm. So, in spite of that, although I'd only actually ever been to one previous Doctor Who convention, which was Panopticon 2000 in Manchester, which was a very lively weekend, and been to a few signings and marts and the like. I've had Doctor Who people there, but just never got around to it, mainly because in recent years I had generally reserved my convention going for Transformers.
Yes.
Yes, previously Transforce and literally Auto Assembly, the main Transformers conventions, but recently I've decided that I would try and branch out a wee bit and go to more varied events, so it's comic events. So I went to this Doctor Who one in Newcastle last weekend, and it was very, very good. It's very enjoyable. There's a wide variety of guests. It was a wee bit out in the sticks, which I wasn't too sure about, because I thought it was a bit strange that it wasn't in Newcastle city centre, as most of the events tend to be. Instead, it was 6 miles out by the A1 and near sort of Warville, because everywhere in the country is Warville, as far as I'm concerned. So actually, it almost put me off going. But I went, and it was nice and quiet, it wasn't hustle and bustle, and it was very good. You had Peter Davison, Sylvester McCoy, the proper Davros.
Roy Drumley.
David Banks, the proper cyber leader. Various companions and some people from Blake 7 and Farscape as well. So really good. But the main highlight, in fact, was in the main hall where it took place, there was a very large and accurate, excellent TARDIS prop, which you'd expect. And on the Freddy, I noticed there were two Daleks. A black Dalek and a grey silver type one.
So the Trooper Dalek.
That's the one, thank you. I remember looking at them and going, oh, those Dalek props are really quite impressive. Well done, whoever made them, because me being the fan, I could tell they were BBC Daleks, which is probably why I'm probably the right person to go to the Doctor Who convention, that I can tell just by looking at it, I can go, yeah, that's a really good fan effort, that's not a real one.
The streets were undoubtedly safer in Edinburgh that weekend because you weren't prowling them.
It's true. Instead of prowling this hotel somewhere near Newcastle. So that was the Friday, and then on the Saturday the various panels were going on during the morning. They came to lunchtime, so I went prowling down the corridors of the hotel, and imagine my surprise when I saw the Daleks moving around towards me. And again, there's the difference between a diehard fan and a casual person. A casual person may have just seen these and went, oh, look, it's Daleks moving about. But I, for instance, know how difficult it is to operate a Dalek. So it was very impressive that they were moving the eye stalk and the gun and the plunger, as well as the Dalek moving around, which is very difficult. plus The Voice. They were doing The Voices, and not only were they doing The Voices, but they were doing a full skit, a comedy skit, and they were fighting each other, and they were threatening to exterminate people, particularly a man with a stick for some reason. They really hated him, because that's what Daleks are like. But the reason why I mention them specifically is because they are called the Northern Charity Daleks. There's Bruce Dalek, and I think the other one's called Derek the Dalek. And they have a website, so if you Google Northern Charity Daleks, you can...
We'll include the link in the post office.
You can look up their website, and basically these people seem to go to various events and do things for charity, raising money by being Daleks and moving around. And I have to say, they were absolutely superb. I mean, they were in these things for at least half an hour or so. I mean, I never saw anyone get out of it. They'd go away, give a lunch, come back, and they were still roaming the corridors. And it's quite a surreal sight as well, because you get used to them, then you go away to your hotel room and get your juice that you've put there, or change your t-shirt because it's a bit hot, and you come in, there's just a Dalek coming in the corner towards you, doing the full voice, and the women, you're under exterminated. So that was fantastic. So that was a nice change of pace for me. So I would actually go to that kind of thing again, because it was a bit more expensive ticket-wise than you're maybe used to from Transformers conventions or comic conventions, but considering that they had pretty much a full programme of events for all a Saturday, all a Sunday, and there was never any gaps or times that I was bored, then it was certainly worth the money, and I would go again. It was very good. So hence why we're recording this podcast now.
And Ralph mentioned obviously that Messrs. Davison and McCoy there, but a certain Doctor wasn't. Obviously, we speak of the Sixth Doctor, who we'll be talking about at length in this podcast, because this is the second of our reviews of the Colin Baker era. At the moment, he is in the Australian, I think it's Australia, for I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here.
Yes, and even though he wasn't at the convention, he was a topic amongst many on the panels by the guests, along the lines of who was putting a bet on him. Fraser Hines, Jamie had put bets on him, I think he put a tenner on him to win, and various other things like that. So.
Now, it's reality TV, it's, to be perfectly honest, I tried watching it out of loyalty for Colin.
It's true.
And I couldn't get past about 10 minutes of the show, if I'm honest. However, what I would recommend is keep an eye on Twitter, because everyone will be talking about it. When it comes time to text or phone your voting to ensure that he's safe if he's up for there, or for him to win, do it. Don't vote for him to do any of those horrible trials, though. Let's leave it to Nadine Dorries to eat those kangaroo anuses and whatever other bits of animal genital that they force celebrities to eat.
Yes, indeed. For if you are a serving MP, for instance, perhaps, and you're being paid to do your job, and you decide to not do your job, but still take your wage as an MP while going off to do something else, then quite frankly, you deserve everything that's coming to you.
Yes.
Oh, political commentary in the Stardom podcast.
Again, what we will say is, We are both Scottish, so we have an innate anti-Tory bias on account of them having fucked over our country for several fucking decades. But let's not talk about politics.
Let's not get into that too much, because you have not downloaded a political podcast.
I think we should do one. We'll do one when it's the referendum for Scotland, so look out for that.
Well, I know, I've still to see all of the House of Cards trilogy with...
we could probably talk about that.
So we could probably do a House of Cards podcast at some point in the future.
You might very well think that. I couldn't possibly comment.
I slapped my thigh.
And right now, little Philip Ayres just punched the air whatever he's listening
to. That's right, little Philip Ayres. We forgot to mention, because as we said in the previous podcast, he'd been promoted to the third member of the podcast. So what do you have to say about that, Phil? Excellent, thank you. Good comment there. And hello to Nick Roche while we're at it.
Indeed as well. So we're picking up the Cuddly Colin retrospective with...
The Two Doctors.
Now, we have a story by Robert Holmes starring Colin Baker with the lovely Nicola Bryant as Mary. You have also, as it suggests, two doctors. We have another doctor.
That's right.
We have Pat Troughton.
Yep.
And Fraser Hines as Jamie. So
you also have Jacqueline Pierce,
who was Servalan in Blake 7. So you have all of these ingredients. Put them together, and it's a recipe for an absolutely amazing 2 hours of television.
It's true. Also, when you add to that the aspect of this comes from the season of Doctor Who, where they were doing it 45-minute chunks. I never took off, eh? Oh, yeah. Anyway, the episodes were generally done as two-part storylines, but the Two Doctors, because there were 13 episodes that year, was accorded an extra episode, so you have a super length thing.
Yes, you have all of these ingredients should put together, and again, Robert Holmes, arguably, over the course of Doctor Who, prior to the 1989, and going off there, arguably probably the best writer in terms of creative highs, consistency.
Variable consistency, but when he was on form, he was on form.
Genesis of the Daleks.
Caves of Androzani. Trial of Time Lord, parts 1 to 14 and 13. 1 to 14, 1 to 4.
And 13.
And 13. Oh, dear me. The reason why I'm perhaps slightly off kilter might become apparent really soon.
Yes.
Yeah, so let's just. We've got a DVD here. And through my throat ravaged tones. I've got a sore throat, so if I'm rasping, you'll know why. The Two Doctors by Robert Holmes, back in the DVD. When we do an accent.
If you're
Spanish accent.
If your throat can take it. And
yeah, because it's set in Spain.
Okay, before we go any further,
yes.
I apologise in advance to anyone who of Spanish ancestry or birth who is offended by what Ralph is about to do.
Here we go.
Continue.
While investigating unauthorised experiments into time travel aboard Space Station Chimera, the Second Doctor and Jamie come under attack on the warlike Santarans. Elsewhere, the Sixth Doctor and Penny are also decide to pay a visit to Chimera. They find the station abandoned, but discover Jamie, half crazed, hiding in the ducting, and he tells them that the Doctor has been murdered. So that's the
plot. Yeah. Now, basically, I'm pretty sure that I could barely understand that, and I'm sitting not more than spitting distance away from Ralph at this point.
Yeah.
So you listening right now have no fucking chance. And you know what? That's not necessarily a problem, because in those 2 hours, there is what I can charitably describe as a thimble full of story. The reason we see that is it starts off quite promising.
It starts well, yeah.
What I really liked about the start was it starts off in the TARDIS of the Second Doctor's era.
And they have actually given them the older comics. So, okay, you could go, oh, it's not the one from the 60s, but honestly, shut up if you think that.
Yeah.
They made a point to make it distinctive from the modern one.
And so you have it starts in black and white, then fades to colour, which was a nice little touch. It's like, okay, it's reminding us that this is the older Doctor. Now, you start off and you notice, obviously, Pat Troughton's aged but still carries it off and can still they should have dyed his hair black and you probably would have been fine.
Yeah.
But the greyish black hair doesn't quite, there's a couple of times it kind of goes takes out a little bit because you notice that the rest of it just works.
Yeah.
So him and Jamie are talking, it's set ostensibly in what has been called 6B.
Yes.
Which is after the end of the War Games, where the Doctor is sentenced to have his face changed and be exiled to Earth. There's long been speculated that there's a gap where the Doctor does things, and in this, there's certain things dialogue.
And if you do actually, I want to have that backed up, there were a couple of books published by BBC Books by Terence Dix, one of which was called Players, being reissued in 2013, where it details the Doctor being given his missions by the Time Lords and going away. So if you want that to have happened, it's fine. We'll ignore the fan criticisms about continuity and stuff because
it's a show about time travel.
Because A, it's nonsense, and B, you know, at the time that they showed the Two Doctors, you weren't getting Patrick Troughton repeats, and most of the episodes were missing. So the viewers, even people who remember Pat Troughton, I'm sure wouldn't have been sitting there shaking their fists. And,
so how dare you give us more Pat
Troughton? Continuity wrong. So anyway, it starts with they go to the space station.
And what it is on the space station, there are scientists ostensibly doing experiments into learning how to travel in time.
Mm.
So the Doctor has been sent by the Gallifreyans to tell them, knock it off, because you don't know what you're doing and could cause some damage.
Gony no day that.
Now, it's, because the Doctor is kind of an outcast, it's plausible deniability. So,
yes.
Again, it's why it's kind of, it is the 6B thing does kind of come through from there. So it starts off, and the head of this scientific organisation, who the Doctor does know, basically just accuses the Time Lords of hypocrisy and meddling and the like, and then appears to have been drugged. and beach balls from space appear.
They saw Tyler and Battlefleet, no less.
Again. And
it's all go.
Exactly, at this point, yeah. And it is. So the Doctor gets taken captive by a... At this point, you don't notice a Son... You don't see it's a Sontaran. You see kind of a hand with big potato fingers.
Big potato fingers with a weapon thing.
Yeah, and that's kind of it. That's your first little on-screen bit of it. Yeah. I mention this because we can come back to it in a little bit. So then the Doctor gets taken away. Jamie's left for dead. The Dastari, the evil chap, and Chesney, played by Jacqueline Pierce, who, if you may remember from Blake 7, if you watched it, is capable of quite a range of performance.
Yes. Very memorable performance style.
In this, she kind of walks around in a silver dress and doesn't do a fuck ton much.
It's true. She's wasted in this.
Yes.
Yeah, fortunately.
And that's pretty much almost all of the main thrust of the narrative for another hour and a half.
Yes.
Because you get really no further forward at that point. We then get the Sixth Doctor and Perry in the TARDIS, as they always seem to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, first they were fishing.
Yeah, fishing, yes. And then back in the TARDIS, he faints because at this point his past self is being attacked.
He's been verbalised by some light.
And they go to find out, and he goes to, just by quirk of fate, ends up at the same station, but this is after Dastari and co. have left, and the Sontarans have wiped out all the other personnel. And there's just long interminable scenes of him sort of trying out with a computer, hiding in a... going in the service ducts, which just looks like the Crystal Maze.
It's true. No better than behind the
lights. No, sadly yes. Not. And then you find out that Jamie's kind of been living rough there for a little while.
While making...
sounding like he's cracking one off in the pipes. And that's the end of part one. So that's, I'm saying, you get a nice burst of 20 minutes of quite dense, there's a lot of stuff to it.
But it's not the most dynamic directing, but it's watchable.
And then but the story starts grinding to a halt.
Yeah. Then episode 2 happens, and they're in Seville, in Spain, and they want to do some sort of experiment to the Second Doctor to get the Razzalon...
Imprimatur.
That's the one. The symbiotic nuclei in Time Lord cells, which give you the power to safely travel through time without being turned into a spooge or disappear into the time stream. While this goes on, the Sixth Doctor's running around a wee bit. It's got a very natty waistcoat, actually. It's really colourful. I quite like one of them. There's a chap called Oscar, who is an out-of-work actor who runs a restaurant, who catches moths with some lass who also works at the restaurant, and they flap around a wee bit. Servalan from Blake 7 flaps around a wee bit as well. Shawkai does some flapping around.
Now, we should...
Yes.
Shawkai is an androgyn, which is it's one of the elements of it. Is the androgyns apparently are some... race of creatures that pursue sensual stimulation, food, violence, whatever, which is kind of what's good. So now Shawkai basically looks like a See You Jimmy style Scotsman.
He's like an evil Russ Abbott from hell.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's so Servalan is one of these creatures who's been experimented on by Dastari to raise her up, because ultimately what he wants to do is to create something that's better than Time Lords. He's one of these god makers. Now he looks like Larry Grayson from the Generation Game in a shiny jumpsuit.
It's true.
With a really shit tiny ponytail.
Yeah.
So he looks caps, you're thinking, fantastic.
Yeah.
But it's one of the most flat, unengaging performances you would get.
Yeah, it's the old character actor Lawrence Payne, who was also in The Gunfighter from Doctor Who. And by that point, he's in career. One of the reasons why he has got funny glasses is he'd had an accident with his eyes. So he was kind of looking for work at the time. But you see him in lots of old British dramas. He's a good character actor. But he just seems bored.
Yep.
Because there's nothing really to his character. I mean, and then episode 3 happens, and to be honest, there's not really much to say about the plot. I mean, generally... I try very hard to be positive about Doctor Who because I love it, and even when it's bad I can still get some enjoyment, and there are some enjoyable things about the two Doctors. I mean as a child at the time I loved it. It was very good. And it was only really as an adult I find it doesn't really work for me. But in terms of positives, I mean, Colin Baker is fine. I mean, I love the dialogue he's given, doesn't help. his part actually isn't written very well by Robert Holmes, unfortunately. But he tries his best and he's always watchable. Nicola Bryant, unfortunately, is just left in the role of being the annoying companion who complains all the time. But again, she wears a very nice outfit.
She does indeed.
She does indeed. She has a very nice bouncing, breast-enhancing outfit, which does help as well. And she does the best with the material. I like some Talons, even when they're shit. So I can still get enjoyment from them.
So, let's talk about when the Sontarans appear on screen. Because the problem is, you get mentioned very early on that it's a Sontaran battle fleet.
It's true.
So you're like, it's a bit disappointing, because they shouldn't have had that. Probably, if Eric Sayward, the finest script editor known to man, had been on the ball, he would have cut that scene, or it would have just said, it's an enemy battle fleet.
Yeah, because even though when the Second Doctor is captured, and you see the Sontaran weapon, although that's now quite distinctive, at the time the Sontarans hadn't been on television in about 10 years.
Well, no, 10.
Well, the invasion of time would have been 76, I want to say.
Green, we'll draw that for the invasion, so you're looking at 77.
Yeah.
That would have been 84, so.
Yeah, so.
7 years. So, yeah. Still, yeah. A long time in terms of TV viewing.
So you can still look at the mystery there.
And when you get the first full shot of the Sontarans, it's just in a room and he turns round and talks to Servalan, Chisaini, as she's called in this, just as a matter of fact. It's like, that's not a reveal of, as I said, what the Doctor, who in what we're going to discuss shortly after that, says next to the Daleks and the Cybermen are the most dangerous, the most evil race in the universe.
So we're told that the reason why they want to go to Earth is because they're still having the interminable war with the Rutans, and there's a big battle about to take place in some sector of space nearby. But because you never see anything to do with it, you never hear any reports from it, and also this Sontaran battle fleet, which you see briefly in part one, you never see it again, there's no excitement.
No.
There's none at all. But again, maybe being me, even crappy Sontarans, still enjoy. And there are some good ideas in the Two Doctors. I mean, I like, you know, although it's not really developed, the idea that there's a space scientist chap and he's found this primitive race, the Androgums, and he thinks, hang on a minute, I can augment one of them and make them up above the gods, as he says a few times, and sort of, you know, work on their baser instincts. They're obsessed with food, and that's pretty much it. And give them intelligence and education and bring them up and give them time travel, and at the same time defy the rule of the Time Lords. I mean, there's a nice idea there about
Prometheus healing fire from
and even the idea that the Time Lords are the force in the universe and they may be trying to stop other races from acquiring the power they have. You could have had something there about the character of the scientist having some kind of character, and either be mad or having a quest for power or a quest for knowledge and rebelling against this alien race or telling them no, and how that leads to a desperate alliance with the Sontarans to forward his aims. And you could have had a tragic aspect there. And as I said, you had a good actor in the role. To be fair, you can't really tell from that performance, but he was a good character actor. Same with Jacqueline Pierce's character, the idea that the space creature has been raised to higher intellect. You've got the actress, she can do it. I mean, sometimes Jacqueline Pierce is put down as being a sort of camp actress and maybe not the greatest actress, and I think that's unfair, because if you actually go back and watch Blake 7 properly and you look at the kind of performance she does, it's actually a very good acting performance. A lot of the time she will raise the level of the script, and yes, it's campy, and yes, it's a bit cheesy and daft, but you know, that actually takes quite a bit of talent to do as much as doing a straight Shakespearean person.
Just ask Richard Briers when you tried to do it in Paradise Towers.
Yes.
And failed miserably.
Yes, so when it's done by... So, again, that's the kind of positives. I mean,
Trout hasn't missed a step.
He's very watchable.
JJ's saddled with getting a little bit at the start, and the interplay between him's good, and then he's just generic man helping the Doctor.
Yeah, there are little moments here and there of kind of proper Holmes writing, like
when Penny and he goes, what kind of conspiracy? And Jamie deadpans and turns, goes, he means a plot.
Yeah, that was good. That was fun.
Which Jamie was always, particularly in his early stories, portrayed as the one that didn't know, because he was from the Jacobite era. So yeah, he was the one constantly being educated. So a nice little flip-flop for just a couple of seconds, and you kind of, so long-term fans are kind of going, brilliant, Jamie just schooled somebody.
Yeah, I saw about the, there's a bit about the Suntanian general chap, has a chat with the second doctor, and there's sort of actually nice wee bits of dialogue there.
The doctor's trying to goad him into releasing him so he can have a fight. Yeah. And questioning his honour, and it's kind of, it's very well played.
Yeah, that's nicely done. So, it's, again, you know, we're, I never like the views that just sit there and just go on about how rubbish and terrible it is, because it'd be very, very easy for this to lay into the two doctors with much more vitriol and annoyance, but it's, I suppose, I think the reason why it annoys me slightly more is
the wasted opportunity. We do know that, that nobody sets out to make, well, apart from those arseholes at Asylum or Trauma, but nobody sets out to make bad films or bad TV shows, but sometimes things happen, and sometimes they say, just because you've got all the components together, the sum isn't always, the whole isn't always great, the sum of its parts, and this is definitely one of them, because when you kind of, if you were to give that to someone who's never seen that particular episode or been aware of it, but is aware of previous Doctor Who and go, you would look and go, by God, that should be amazing.
Yeah.
And it's, I think that's more to do with it than anything else. And that probably does colour our perception.
I mean, and if it was maybe a two-parter rather than a three-parter, I think, I don't know, even the same storyline, I don't think it maybe solve the storyline problems, but certainly it would solve a lot of the pacing problems. Yeah. And if it was two, I think I'd look kinder on it. But I would still say it's worth a watch. I mean, it's, I think it's the weakest Colin Baker story. By a country mile, it's the one that's a bit of a challenge to sit through at times, but it has its moments, and give it a go, because worst comes to worst, you've got Patrick Troughton.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I mean, as I said, I think probably it's like a good deal of our perception coloured by the disappointment feeling that it's not amazing.
Yeah.
Because of what we're expecting going in, it's kind of, it's like to be honest, it's probably, again, it does account for why both of us, and this is to a silent member of the podcast, Phil Bears, both hate Destiny of the Daleks as much, because it's Tom Baker, Daleks,
Douglas Adams,
Davros.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't work.
Yeah. I should love it as well, because Douglas Adams is my favourite writer, and will always be my favourite writer, but it just doesn't work for me. But I think Destiny of the Daleks is probably worthy of a podcast chat properly at some future point.
I think it would have to be when Phil isn't the silent member, because I think if we were to record a diatribe about this, he might not let Liz make cake for us.
It's true.
And we are mercenary.
But talking of mercenary, let's talk about the special extra feature that's on the two doctors.
Yes, now this takes a rather sinister turn. Now the reason is, Doctor Who was an odd beast in terms of how BBC was organised, because it was ostensibly a drama show that kind of came under a lot of the children's area, and there's a lot of crossover, because it was one of the, in fact, I'd argue in the 80s probably the last bastion of proper family television.
Yeah, I mean, hence what I said earlier, I said the two doctors, I would still watch it anyway, because, or even if you've got a younger person in the household, because I did love it as a child.
Yeah.
So maybe it is one of those ones that maybe works better for the younger audience, who knows. Yeah.
So, in the 80s, there was a programme that we all loved called Jim Will Fix It. Now, if you happen to have internet access, and even if you're not in Britain, you know some British people, you'll have seen on Twitter some of them probably making jokes, but not like we have, sadly, about Jim Will Fix It had the then popular former DJ and TV presenter, Jimmy Savile, who basically presented a show where kids could write in asking for certain things, and he would grant their wishes.
Yes.
Sadly, as it turns out, that's kind of, it's a tip of a very ugly, dark and black.
Yes, we're not really going into it too much here, because A, this is not the time and place, and it's far too serious. But generally, just for context, when this DVD came out, one of the things that did excite me about purchasing the DVD, other than the two doctors and the absolutely excellent 45-minute documentary about Robert Holmes, which, to be honest, it's worth getting a DVD literally just to watch that. It's a fantastic feature. Very well put together, one of the best features in the range, actually, was that it had a mini episode from the aforementioned Jim Will Fix It television show called In A Fix With Some Talents. And the reason why it was exciting was because, as Andy said, when we watched Jim Will Fix It as children, until recently we were unaware that Jimmy Savile himself was apparently a
rather senile paedophile,
despicable human being. But it was a TV show we liked, and I remember writing into Jim Will Fix It because I wanted to be in an episode of Doctor Who with Colin Baker, who was my favourite. So I remember tuning in for Jim Will Fix It and missing the start of it and thinking I got the time wrong for Doctor Who, because I just literally just switched on just as this mini episode started, where a child called Gareth Jenkins was given his wish to appear in an episode of Doctor Who. And whereas now we're used to little 5-minute skits for children in need or comic relief or whatever, a little adventure for the Doctor, or maybe a little prequel to a special episode, this was unusual. So the time to actually see this little mini episode again was very exciting, because the DVD of the two Doctors came out in 2003. Pre-YouTube, and yes, there were places online where you could look at stuff, but generally most of us were still on dial-up.
Certainly in this country.
Yeah, anyway. With dial-up anyway, and things like this you just couldn't get access to see. So at the time it was very exciting to watch, actually. So the plot of In A Fix With Some Talents is...
The Doctor is in the TARDIS, as it transpires and as we find out through dialogue as it goes along. Two Sontarans have managed to get on board and have a Vitrox bomb which they need to use the power of the TARDIS to prime, and they're going to blow up. Now, he accidentally activates a matter transporter and teleports a former companion, Tegan Yavanka, played by Janet Fielding,
yes,
into the TARDIS. They have a little bit of an argument, as you always do when Tegan's involved.
It's true.
They're mucking about trying to sort the console, trying to sort things out to thwart the Sontarans, and little Gareth Jenkins appears. Now, part of what he did was his letter was basically saying he had a costume of a Doctor Who, Sixth Doctor costume made by his nan, and he wanted to be in it, and he's got a TARDIS.
Understandable, yeah. I would have loved to have that costume. In fact, I'd love to have that costume now. I'm wearing the T-shirt right now.
I'm wearing my Doctor T-shirt for context. Yes. So he appears, and he is wearing this costume. Now, the problem is, one, I'm a horrible, horrible cynic, so right away I noticed he had half-mast trousers.
It's true.
That's a horrible, horrible fashion faux pas. And also, the waistcoat he had was too short.
True.
So, so he did look kind of like a little mini tramp version. And so he gets to help kill Sontarans.
That's right, the Doctor, the man who never would.
Gasses Sontarans to death in his own TARDIS till their faces melt and turn inside.
And has a child help him commit this genocidal act within the TARDIS. State of grace, my hairy arse.
That's not genocide, that's homicide. It's only two men.
Well, for all we know, he's going to be the last two Sontarans in existence. We don't know when the time stream this happens.
It's possible. The clone banks, so unless he's destroyed clone banks, there'll be more.
I don't know when, we just know they're still with the Oregon and the Rutans.
Yeah, so... yes. And then Jimmy Savile appears at the end to have a little bit of...
Yeah, it's one of those unfortunate things where it used to be funny. When the scan of the TARDIS came on and the Doctor said, oh, it's the most evil... terrible thing in the universe, and Jimmy Savile's face appears on the screen, ooh, like that, and then he appears through the TARDIS doors, and they do a little thing with giving the kids a prop gun, the Sontarans had the Mizon gun, as a wee gift, and he gets his Jim Will Fix It badge.
It's not really a wee gift, it's almost the size of it.
It is actually almost bigger than him, yeah,
it's like, congratulations to Colin, you're giving him a hernia, because that's what's happened to him, trying to carry that home.
So, what could he say about anything? On its own merits, it's a harmless throwaway skit that was on a variety show. But unfortunately, context has now changed, and
the DVD is no longer. I think I don't think it's so much deleted as that they aren't printing anymore, so it's kind of done, because they'll obviously be gearing up for the Blu-ray
releases. Yeah.
It's one of these things that sadly, I think will become a little bit of a slightly macabre collector's item, because I cannot see the BBC authorising that content.
No, and to be honest, because unfortunately we now know...
For those of us who are wrestling fans, and we obviously know the Chris Benoit tragedy, we're already averse to that, whereby he was a very popular wrestler. but after he took the life of his wife and son, the WWE have quite rightly pretty much airbrushed him from history and don't release stuff with him on if they can avoid it, and there's no mention of him. He's kind of, and absolutely is kind of the right thing to do, because you don't want to be portraying these people as heroes. And the sad thing is, probably because of the programming that Jimmy Savile did, there's very little that would be able to portray him in a negative light. He would just, anything that comes out, he looks, because I'm presenting a pop show, I'm giving kids their fondest wishes, and just no, it's...
So, basically, you know, we don't want to go into it too much, because let's not lower the tone, but it's a curiosity. If you want to see it, then...
It'll be on YouTube. And that's about, I think, very soon the only place you'll be able to find it.
Which, to be honest, I don't think it's too bad a thing, really. So, moving on a lighter note, we are about to use the power of editing. That's right. You might experience a small pause with perhaps a
musical interlude.
While a musical interlude is going on, we're going to compress time itself. In fact, we may even be falling through the time lapse.
Indeed, we survived.
It's true. Why are we talking about time lashes? Well, that's because the next exciting Doctor Who adventure is indeed called...
Time Lash.
Ooh. Now, before we discuss Time Lash, it's worthwhile prefacing it with some knowledge, which is that generally amongst perceived Doctor Who fan wisdom, it's seen as one of the great all-time turkeys.
Isn't it, like, bottom almost all the time?
Pretty much bottom all the time, indeed. Even when Doctor Who magazine have conducted various polls over the years, which would include people maybe writing in who maybe aren't forum people or knee-deep in the fandom, maybe just buy Doctor Who magazine and enjoy it on a less die-hard manner.
Yeah.
Generally, it's perceived as the epitome of shit. The pig's will of despair, if you like. The Duran Duran of Doctor Who.
Oh, what
are you hating on Duran Duran for? It's not very good.
Shock! Wise! Our Bloody World's a great tune.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
It's a dirge.
You just hate them because they did a really bad Bond theme, and that's it, isn't it?
That is the main reason for my hatred of them. But anyway, but Time Lash is seen, along with The Twin Dilemma, which you previously discussed.
Yes.
That's pretty much, as I say, the bottom of the bottom. Now, these people are wrong.
They are.
They are. Time Lash, while not a classic.
No, while, I don't think we would...
No.
I tend to argue that.
No, it's not a classic, nor is it one of the greats.
No.
Nor is it, even to be honest, one of the so bad it's good greats. It's actually very entertaining if watched in a certain frame of mind.
Yeah, and if we're honest, it's not as bad as all that. And, well, I'll let Ralph give you the back of the
yes.
DVD blurb.
Now, just before I discuss the DVD blurb, the DVD came out in 2007, when, for the brief period of time, the Doctor Who DVD range tried to have a sort of secondary range of budget titles, where they would have less features than the main range, but they would still have a commentary track, an audio, a text commentary, one featurette, remastered. So basically, even their "we don't put much into it" titles did more than most DVDs.
I think what we have to say is, in terms of DVD ranges, both not just in terms of television, but films, I think you're hard pushed to find ones that are actually more value for money, certainly in terms of bonus content, than the Doctor Who DVDs.
Yes. And the reason why I mentioned that is because the one extra feature that has, other than the commentaries, was a documentary called The Good, The Bad and The Ugly. And the whole thrust of the documentary was to try and explain why, when people try and make something good, it could turn out to be bad. Because even selling a DVD of Time Lash was seen as a...
uphill struggle.
Yeah, what do we do with this one, basically? And it's actually quite a decent wee feature, actually. It's not laying into it too thickly. It's more balanced than you would think. But Time Lash, it's actually quite entertaining. Before we discuss the show, let's read the back of the DVD blurb.
Can you try and do it in a Paul Darrow channeling Laurence Olivier doing Richard III?
I shall try.
Challenge extended. you can't see it, but if you've watched Time Lash, there's some wonderful hand acting from Paul Darrow. Ralph's doing it now. He's committing to the role.
True. I'm just preparing myself.
The TARDIS gets cut in the Time Lash. A powerful time corridor that brings the Doctor and Peri to the troubled planet of Kafel. The planet is on the brink of war and ruled by an insane and much feared dictator who punishes Kafelans by throwing them into the Time Lash. But why is the leader never seen in person? And what links Kafel of 19th century Scotland? Then Doctor arrives, just in time to find out. Dot.
What was that?
That was Paul Darrow.
That was not Paul Darrow.
That was Paul Darrow. That was like
I could have sworn blind you were fucking Dr. Dacca from the 47 Batman series. Like, dude, Yellow Peril's bad. We hate Mike Costa for it. Stop fucking doing it with your voice.
No, that was perfect Paul Darrow diction.
Well,
I have demonstrated over the many episodes how good I am at impersonation.
You are like at right angles to perfect Paul Darrow diction, indeed to any kind of action.
I was channeling Paul Darrow. Paul Darrow plays a character.
Like mainlining fucking crystal meth.
Paul Darrow, who appears in this production, appears as an evil body called Malin Tekker on the planet of Kafel. So the scene is set. There is Kafel, and there's the planet of the Banjos. The Banjos, featuring the Banjo ambassador, who's a sort of like sock puppet type chap.
He's a snake sock puppet with a really plummy and uninterested voice.
yes, he is in fact amazing. So into this sort of situation where the Borad, who's an evil chap who sort of controls...
He seems to have usurped
the power base
yeah.
on.
He controls the Citadel and appears as like an older chap on view screen communications.
But never appears in person.
Never appears in person. He's banned all mirrors and the like from
all reflective surfaces.
Yeah. And there are 500 people in the Citadel. We're
yes.
told. Yes. All the 500 of us. So, in this situation, you've got a sort of ruling council with particularly bad chairs, some of which don't have backs, which is
yeah.
a shame. And they pronounce judgments beside a tinsel portal called the Time Lash. And when people disturb the peace and don't obey the rule of the Borad, they have a wee quick meeting, sentence you to punishment of being pushed through the Time Lash portal, which is a time corridor, which will send you to 19th century Scotland, as it turns out. It could be worse though, they could send you to 21st century Glasgow and get you the shit beaten out of you. But there you go. And yes, I can say that because I'm from Glasgow. Now,
Andy would say it anyway, you've heard his accent, he really doesn't care.
Ah, it's mon. Anyway, so.
There's juice. What's loose? Cool. I'm good then, juice.
Indeed. So, the people are sent through the Time Lash. One of the people that's sent through, Vina, is played by an actress with a unique performance style, I would say. It's like the performance style of someone who's permanently sort of drinking paint thinner between scenes.
She is semi-sedated.
Yeah.
I would be
it's looking, a beautifully bad performance. It's highly entertaining.
It's because it's not only that she's so slow in her delivery and her response. There's a scene, we'll skip near the end, where the Doctor triumphs, as he does. It's not a spoiler, because there's another episode after called with Doctor Who in it.
Oh.
So he escapes. But there's a bit where he blows up the Time Lash.
Oh, you spoiled it now.
I'm totally fucking ruined it for everybody, isn't I?
Fuck's sake, I'm switching this off.
So, everybody runs to take cover behind the impressively unbacked seats of the council.
Yes.
So she, everybody sprints, apart from her, who is at this point pretty much closest to cover.
Yeah.
And is still the last, because she's just doddering along.
I mean, she's either on crystal meth or Morgadon. The character, not the actress, of course. At all times.
Yeah.
That's good. So anyway, so people have been banished through the Time Lash to 19th century Scotland, which is seen as a fate worse than death. Which is a bit of a shame. I mean, I wouldn't say it's a fate worse than death, because they've been banished a full century before the Scottish invention of the battered deep fried pizza. Supper.
That's a fate worse
yeah,
than death.
Yeah, you know, which we can take because we're natives, but which horrifies anyone else you speak to. So it's probably the wrong destination to send them to. Anyway. So Vina, this woman character, is thrown, falls into the Time Lash, and passes through the Time Corridor, and passes through the TARDIS, which is experiencing mechanical difficulties.
Because of the Time Lash itself, which shouldn't be used.
Yes,
it's unstable.
Yes, and there's a fantastic scene where the Doctor and Perry attach themselves to the TARDIS console with seatbelts and do a sort of ride thing, which is fantastic. And then he lands in the Citadel.
You sold that,
yes.
Didn't you? Which was fantastic.
Yes. It is. And they land in the Citadel, and they meet Paul Darrow, who's subsequently taken over as the Malin, who's the sort of like the head honcho chap of the council, who reports directly to the board.
Basically, like the major domo to the.
Now, Paul Darrow, I think, is one of Britain's great. Great actors who's never had the recognition I think he actually deserves. Because again, a bit like what we're talking about beforehand in terms of camp performances, there is an art to doing it. There is a talent involved in doing that archness.
Yeah, it's very difficult to do. And all you have to do is look at his work, again, going back to, obviously, previous one was Blake 7.
Yes.
Whereby, if we're all honest, who really gave a flying fuck about Blake?
I did.
Really?
Yes.
I did. He bored the tits off me. It's like, Avon was by far and away the best
Blake
to watch.
Don't you? That's Blake.
Do you want to come back and argue with me when your balls are dropped?
Blake is the wholemeal sandwich that holds the sausage in of the first 2 years of Blake 7. He's fantastic. Avon is brilliant. Avon is yes, the star of the show, I would agree, and he is what carries it through. But without the foundation of Blake as the firmament, it wouldn't work.
Okay, but here's the thing. If Avon wasn't in that show, nobody would have watched it. It would have died in his ass.
No! No, Blake is not, not because the first episode of Blake 7 which is, doesn't have Avon in it.
Okay, here's the thing.
It's fantastic.
There are, like Blake 7 itself, there are two Blakes. There is the Blake in the first three episodes, then there is the Blake that comes after.
Who is is fantastic.
But as I say, when you've got past the first three episodes, I would agree with you, if they'd kept that tone of the first three episodes, you could have done without Avon. Blake would have been a good lead for it.
He still was a good lead.
But after it, sorry, if I would take Avon in the show before Blake by a country mile.
You go in a hole. You go in that hole. You climb in that hole with no food and you die in that hole.
Meanwhile, back in Carfell, the planet and the time lash, evil Paul Dano is taking over. He does lots of hand movements. And
very good hand acting.
Yeah, lots of it. It's like, see, I'm doing the thing because that's what he does on screen.
Ralph's continually doing all these gestures, really for me, which is like, I've just watched Time Lapse. I'm aware of the gestures. For our listening audience, they're just going, what the fuck is one half of that idiot duo doing?
anyway, there's subplots and adventures, and there are things about Time Lapse that, anyway, so there's things that aren't discussed, which we're not going to discuss, because the plot goes on. There's evil, the boy lad is a bad, evil, mutated chap. Doctor has to defeat him. H.G. Wells is involved. But you can get all this from episode guides. What we need to talk about is Beekeeper number 5.
Yes.
Now, in context, in this period of Doctor Who, barely an episode goes by without some sort of evil, villainous chap. Usually the main evil villain of the story, lusting after Penny.
This one is no different.
The Borad is doing the whole...
There's sort of guards that work for the Borad now. I think they're androids, and they basically are unhappy jobbing actors and or extras covered, wearing a ridiculous outfit. Some of them with a dildo hand attachment.
That's true.
All of them with stupid blue face paint.
Yeah, and they are in league with the beekeeper chaps.
No, they are the same.
Oh.
But what happens is some of them have to wear beekeeper hats.
Yes.
And during the imbroglios of the two-parters, one of them manages to capture Perry. We've called him Beekeeper number 5.
Yes.
It may not be his number, but
I believe it is his number.
I feel it should be.
Yes.
However, what he does is he gets Perry in some strange sort of harness that's holding her hands.
Yeah.
But
he comes at her,
he does,
and he puts it around her neck and takes her away to his sex dungeon.
Yes, he basically puts her on a leash.
Puts her on a leash, he takes her away, it's the last you see of her. Then there's a period of time that passes. Then the next cut to what looks off all the world like
the Carful sex dungeon.
The Carful sex dungeon, where she's been chained up again, and he sort of comes in and he goes out and he takes her away to do something else, which also involved taking her to a cave where a giant penis-shaped puppet monster waves its head towards her. Thus is the subtext of Time Lapse Review.
Yes.
Who was Beekeeper number 5?
Legend.
How did he succeed when all other villains failed? What really was going on? What's the motivation of him, do you think?
Nicola Bryant, it's lovely.
I don't know.
Why are you? That's not. You've watched the thing. Why are you even asking that question?
I'm trying to look deeper into the main text of the story to unveil the hidden depths.
You saw Nicola Bryant on the pumper. There you go. Motivation over. You could look deep inside him and find a big blue-faced alien beekeeper man that wanted to pump Nicola Bryant. It's not a bad thing. We hear
it's a bad thing when you've got a dungeon.
Whoa! Dungeons can sometimes be. Not all dungeons are made by Joseph Thistle. Sometimes dungeons are used for consensual activities, such as Max Mosley did, as the certain tabloid newspapers found out to their cost. Well, he sued them.
Why did not be sued?
That's why I said dungeons can be consensual. I point out that Max Mosley, when he paid hookers to dress up like Nazis to engage in sadomasochistic activities, as I said, were purely consensual. They were not necessarily Nazi themed. Again, the connotation being because his father being Sir Oswald Mosley.
Yeah.
Politics, two episodes.
Two
parts of the
episode. Two parts of the episode in a row. This is why Time Lapse is
culture.
Time Lapse is good because it leads you into discussion of all the topics of the day.
But as I said, sometimes people can build the dungeons for consensual use between willing and consenting partners who enjoy some of the experiences on the sort of fringes of what would be acceptable behaviour.
Well,
so you're making a prejudgment.
But also,
it looked like it was old and had already been used, so he built it himself, so he's not a Fritz
of Cagney. Beekeeper number 5 was one of the enforcers of the Borad, the evil chap, who made the evilness stay evil on this evil place. So, you know, I don't think he was a nice chap. I mean, he disappears, we don't really find out what happens to Beekeeper number 5. At the end of the story, the Banjos make peace with the Kerfelons, and who goes on there? Maybe there's a truce, maybe there's a sort of repatriation of war criminals. Beekeeper number 5 might go to the Banjo planet, he might overcome his sex dungeon fetishes and lead a productive life as a useful member of space society. We just don't know.
What can only hope?
Big Finish.
As you said, where is Banjo Empire?
Yeah, that's Banjo. The Banjos are fantastic because they just don't give a shit. It's like at one point the Doctor's on the space center.
He kind of says, we've deposed the Borad, yeah. It's all going to be safe, you can stop it, there doesn't need to be war, because we'll only accept that if we can see the Borad in chains or defeated. Because, well, that's going to prove it, because, doesn't matter.
And just switches off the screen and launches an enormous bomb towards the planet.
That's brilliant. I like
that. From a production point of view, the Borad makeup is absolutely first rate.
It's one of the things, because Time Lash had no money.
Yes.
Because I think being sandwiched between the two stories it was, which is the preceding two Doctors and what falls after Revelation of the Daleks.
Both of which have location filming and large casts and all that business.
And those are obviously the stories you're going to chuck money at. Time Lash, unfortunately. But it kind of works in his favour in that the Borad is making the place dull and dour anyway.
Yeah, which actually is done reasonably well with the production design. The Borad's lair is actually really good and properly lit.
And the Borad makeup job is fantastic. And now, it does look like, and deliberately is meant to be, it's kind of like half a Loch Ness Monster mask glued to his face, but the way it's been done is what makes it. It does actually, it is one of the more convincing makeup effects in Doctor Who, which has been saddled over the years, or certainly for the classic era, with, I think, a number of monster designs and prosthetics that don't quite cut the mustard.
Or maybe beyond the budget and time that they had available to realise them.
Yes, so it's basically get it done and out there. Let's the half-formed Vervoidy one, not the proper Vervoids,
yes,
but the one that had the unearthed, that looked like a dude with stuff stuck to him.
No, it was a lass.
Or lass, but it looked
like...
That was
great.
It looked...
No! No! I don't need to give further explanation. The simple no proves that you're wrong.
But there have been, as I say, some very good makeup effects in Doctor Who. The Davros mask, except on David Gooderson, because it didn't fit and he was rubbish. But let's not hold against David Gooderson, who is a very good actor in his own right.
Yes.
A very shit Davros.
It's not his fault he was in Destiny of the Daleks, the worst Doctor Who serial ever made. Not the worst Doctor Who story. That, of course, is the one we don't talk about. But it's the worst studio.
So, and I think certainly during sort of the latter JNT era, I mean, you had Shanna's Jack on Case of Angela, was also a very good makeup job as
very
well.
Good makeup, yeah.
And this is one of the ones that does hold up quite well looking at it. Obviously, I'm sure now it would maybe be augmented with some CG and stuff, as usually is the case, but it's a very good makeup job. And the best thing about the Borad is.
He's evil!
No.
He's got a good chuckling voice.
No.
He's got a layer of doom.
No.
He's got clones. He's got androids.
No. What he has is, because the Borad can't be seen, because obviously people would just go, he's a mutiny ugly bastard.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
There's the face of the Borad, which is some of an old looking man. Now, what it looks like is, I think ostensibly you're meant to believe it's like an android puppet type thing.
Yes.
But to all intents and purposes, it looks like he's just got like an old dude, tramp, and wired him up.
Space Jakey.
And it was brilliant. When you see it was just in one scene where you see him just walk to the back, it's all these cables, and it's just like, that's brilliant.
Mm-hmm. That's quite an effective wee reveal. Other things like, you know, in 19th century Scotland, where we see H.G. Wells' sort of little house.
Because he was in.
Yeah, decent wee set, nothing wrong with it. The effects are fine. Now, at this point, of course, no discussion of Time Lash can be complete. If a discussion of the Time Lash interior itself and the exciting action sequence.
which forms the beginning of part two, where there may be some dissent within the ranks. Now, as part of the plot, the Doctor must go into the Time Lash itself on a rope
to achieve a crystal.
And he's told by Vina, the aforementioned Mogadon woman, that he's dangling on the edge of oblivion itself. So he goes into this fantastic set. It's a brilliant set. It looks a bit like the Giant's Causeway, but on its side. There's sort of flickering lights and things like that. And he has to go in and he negotiates and he gets it. And it's fucking brilliant. I'm not being about it. It's a great wee sequence. I love it.
It's utterly, oh, utterly shush. Glacial. It's not, where it's the momentum of the story really grinds to halt. Because I like the design. It is a good design, it's and it does work.
Yes,
but it takes forever to do.
That's because the Doctor's struggling. It's a physical ordeal.
It's one where the set design is not good enough to suggest the jeopardy, and the lead actor's having to do a bit too much of the work to do that. It just doesn't quite work.
There's plenty of jeopardy. If I'd been later in the Doctor's life, the rope would have snapped.
Yes, yes. If I'd been when Cuddly Colin was more cuddly.
Yes.
Now, as I said, Time Lash gets a kicking. Now, having viewed it after the two Doctors, now the last time I actually watched Time Lash was when part-time Stardub contributor Carl Thurgood tried to throw himself back down my stairs after a bit too much vodka and didn't last the Trial of a Time Lord marathon.
Well, you know, such mishaps happen to us all.
Do happen. But as I said, Time Lash is one of these ones that gets a kicking much undeserved. It's easy to do because it's one thing. It's like, oh, fans criticise, oh, it's cheap. And it's like, but they hate it when people outside the show criticise all of Doctor Who as cheap. So it's like, shut the fuck up. It does. It works well with its resources.
Yeah, it's entertaining. If you go into expecting great drama,
you're not getting it.
You're not getting it. If you go in expecting a Doctor Who great, you're not getting it. But if you just want 90 minutes of passable, amusing, campy, silly, daft nonsense with a good villain and Paul Dano being arch, then you're sorted. Whether it's one that you might maybe not be one that you return to. I mean, it'll be one that you even have to seek out to purchase, but you can always rent these from Love Film and the like, I believe.
Yep.
So, and to be honest, it is one of the ones that does turn up very, very cheap because no one gives a toss about Time Lash. But I give a toss about Time Lash.
I enjoy
it. And everyone should toss about Time Lash.
Let's not go there. That's a dark, dark place.
Bit like the dark place of Beekeeper number 5, yes. Dick Perry.
No, it was well lit. But as is the curse of the Easy Dirt from the 80s. I'm not touching that lightning rig.
So, we come to the end of this exciting instalment. We will return to the Sixth Doctor Era for Revelation of the Daleks and Trial of a Time Lord, Dimensions in Time, and Arc of Infinity in later podcasts.
Whoa.
Yes.
Dimensions in Time.
It's a broadcast Doctor Who story on BBC One with Colin Baker.
I know, but I just watched it last week for no discernible reason I can actually account for other than I fucking hate myself.
Well, you get to watch it again when we come to review it on the podcast. Jesus. And
that'll be in 2020. That probably will be in 2013, actually, I think.
So, our next episode, we'll return to our more usual varied mixed bag.
Yes, so in the meantime, if you have comments and the like, obviously, you can post them on the Stardub website at www.star-dub.com.
You can find me on Twitter at, all one word, Stardubbing.
I'm the same, not a Stardom, obviously, because it's a Twitter account. I'm Andrew D. Turnbull. We also have presences on the Full Metal Hero Forum, the Transmasters UK Forum, and the Nerdfear Network Forum. And also, if you are checking the Stardom website out, we are currently in the throes of the Daily Straxes still, and when this comes out, it will be installment 38. That's right, I'll have had 38 consecutive days of comic strips involving everybody's favourite robot head in a bowl of water.
Hooray!
Do you have anything to plug or whore while we're here for the next couple of minutes?
No. Goodbye.
Farewell!